Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. A person having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tom Goldstein, and I represent the plaintiffs, and I've reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal. The panel in this case, of course, held that under the Administrative Procedure Act, the plaintiffs could, I just want to make sure Judge Griffith is about volume loud enough, that the plaintiffs under the Administrative Procedure Act could challenge the procedures established by the IRS in Notice 2006-50. The IRS challenges that holding on a variety of grounds. They spend about 6 pages on the question of whether the notice is even final agency action subject to the APA and whether our claim is ripe. But their big argument is that APA jurisdiction has been withdrawn here by the Anti-Injunction Act and the Declaratory Judgment Act, and that's where I intend to start, although I'm obviously prepared to discuss all of the issues in the case. It never hurts to start with the statutory text, and we start with the Administrative Procedure Act, which in Section 704 says that final agency action for which there is no other adequate remedy in a court is subject to judicial review, and there, of course, is no exception for the IRS. And so we start from the premise that this is, absent some withdrawal of jurisdiction, a straightforward APA case. They have a final agency action, a rule here, Notice 2006-50, that's subject to the APA. And the Supreme Court has told us, and this Court has reaffirmed, that there's a standard for deciding whether APA jurisdiction has been withdrawn. The Supreme Court has said in the Lindahl case that there has to be clear and convincing evidence of an intent to withdraw jurisdiction under the APA. And our position is that there isn't anything close to clear and convincing evidence. The statutes that they rely on, again, turning to the text, as I said, are the AIA and the DJA. So let's turn to them. The Anti-Injunction Act provides, quote, except as provided in specified sections, and they're not involved here, no suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax shall be maintained in any court by any person. And our position on that statute is really straightforward. We're not here about the assessment or collection of any tax. This tax has already been collected. We know it was collected illegally. The question is, what are the, in our case, what are the procedures for getting it back? So they lean harder on the Declaratory Judgment Act and the fact that it has broader language. It says that in a case of actual controversy within its jurisdiction, except with respect to federal taxes, and they focus on the breadth of that language, with respect to federal taxes, any court of the United States may declare the rights and other legal relations of any interested party seeking such declaration. So there is declaratory judgment jurisdiction in the federal district courts, except with respect to federal taxes. Now, there's a big debate in the briefs. The dissent in the panel was very concerned with the question of the difference between the AIA and the DJA that the latter talks about with respect to federal taxes. And to be perfectly honest, we don't care. That's just the truth of the matter, because if we're going to be serious about the statutory text, we have to be serious about the whole statutory text, and the DJA is about declaratory judgments.
And can I ask you a question on that? Because at the panel level, obviously, we are bound by prior panel precedent, so this coterminous thing. But if we're going to start afresh, I'm trying to do what you're doing, which is to look at the statutes. And so the DJA seems to say no declaratory relief with respect to federal taxes. That's a problem for your declaratory relief. I agree with you that the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't seem to bar the injunctive relief. Of course, that creates a puzzle. How do you have a suit that allows to injunctive relief but not declaratory relief?
We don't think it's a puzzle, actually.
Let me finish one thing, which is, it seems to me that the Anti-Injunction Act, from looking back at the cases, was just one codification of a broader principle that has existed since the Judiciary Act of 1789, which is you can't get injunctive relief where there's an adequate remedy at law. So that the broader principle that may, emphasis on may, I just want to ask about this, bar your claim for injunctive relief may not be the AIA, but maybe that broader principle. And it's referred to in Bob Jones, Note 16. It's referred to And so if we're starting before we get to the coterminous, which camp you're in coterminous,
right.
Can you address that possibility?
Sure. And I actually don't think we have to... The thing I would caution against is the notion that there is a principle in the air. There are a bunch of very specific statutes at issue here, and they actually deal with the point you're raising, which is if you have some other way of getting relief at law, then don't use a particular route. So let me point to the two statutes that I think raise exactly your concern, mm-hmm. and I do think it's a real issue we have to confront. One I mentioned, and that's the APA itself. Remember, the APA says that we can go into court when there is no other adequate remedy in a court, and I think we have to confront that. And then probably the best statute for them, to be perfectly honest, is not the AIA or the DJA, but it's Section 7422A. So here, let me talk about that. No suit or proceeding shall be maintained in any court for the recovery of any internal revenue tax alleged to have been erroneously or illegally assessed or collected until a claim for refund or credit has been duly filed with the Secretary according to the provisions of law in that regard and the regulations of the Secretary established in pursuance thereof. And so I think both those statutes, to be perfectly honest, make the point you are making. But it's not kind of a generalized sense that if you could go somewhere else, you can't challenge the regulations. I think we have to satisfy the statutory text under the APA. We have to prove that we have no other adequate remedy. And under 7422, we have to prove that this is not a suit for a refund. So maybe I'll just tackle both of those. So the question is, do we have another adequate remedy at law for purposes of the APA? And the answer to that question, I think, is no. So the remedy that we have under the law, other than the APA, is provided by Notice 2006-50, right? Under Notice 2006-50, we could have filed a tax...
I take it that in addressing this, you're addressing also its adequacy for purposes of injunction law, not just for purposes of the APA statute.
Yes, absolutely.
Since I believe Judge Kavanaugh's question.
Yes, absolutely right. So the question is, the APA says if we could bring our claim some other way, if we have some other adequate way of bringing our claim, then we can't come in under the APA and seek an injunction.
Why wouldn't the refund suit be an adequate place to raise these?
Exactly the point where I'm at. So let's just talk first about what that refund suit would have had to have looked like. The only refund suit the panel quite rightly held, and the service only barely contests in its brief in this court, the only refund mechanism we had available is the refund mechanism under Notice 2006-50. We had to either file our 2006 tax return, or we had to, if we were a non-filer, file the special EZ form and the additional documentation that's required. And our point, the entire point of our lawsuit is that Notice 2006-50 is illegal. So it is not it is by definition, if we are right in the substance of our claim, it is not an adequate remedy. Our point, so that's how we approach this question. That is, for purposes of...
Why can't you contest that in the process itself? You file your claim, your administrative claim, you lose, you then go to court, and in court challenge the fact that you didn't get a refund and challenge the adequacy of the procedures.
Well, two reasons. The first is that for APA purposes, you are not required to go ahead and pursue an administrative exhaustion scheme when your claim is that the administrative exhaustion scheme is illegal. And so the authority for that, there are a bunch of cases hold it, but one would be, we cite Berry versus Barchi, which the Supreme Court decided in 1979. It was reiterated by the Supreme Court in McCarthy versus Madigan in 1992. Quote, in a similar vein, exhaustion is not required where the challenge is to the adequacy of the agency procedure itself, such that the question of the adequacy of the administrative remedy is for all practical purposes identical with the merits of the plaintiff's lawsuit.
Is the theory there that the complaint your clients have is that they should not be subject to this unlawful procedure?
Yes.
It's almost like a qualified immunity. I mean, maybe that's not a good analogy,
right.
but the protection is to be free from this illegal procedure itself.
Right. So we don't have to go through the illegal procedure in order to challenge the illegal procedure. It's not, in the terms of the APA, not an adequate remedy. You don't have to go through the illegal hoop in order to say the hoop is illegal. So that's Notice 2006-50. The only other kind of in-the-air sense that we should go through some other procedure would be, is there some other tax refund procedure other than Notice 2006-50? Is there some other sort of generic refund procedure? And the panel was quite right that the answer to that question is no. There is no, under the IR, in the Internal Revenue Code, just a general way of seeking a refund. Just to return to the text again, that is Section 7422. It says we can't sue for a refund unless we go according to the provisions of law in that regard and the regulations of the Secretary established in pursuance thereof. And the mechanism for getting the excise tax back is Notice 2650. So on the question of APA, whether there's an adequate remedy, the answer is no, and that's why this is a straightforward APA claim.
I agree with you about there not being a mechanism other than Notice 2650, but on 2650 itself, you either have to check a box on the tax return, or if you want to claim additional more than the standard amount, you add the 8913, or if you're a non-filer, you file the Form 1040 EZT. Okay, so you do one of those three things, and you say, I'm entitled to more money, and this procedure is illegal, and the IRS says no, and then you file suit. Why can't all that be considered in the refund suit? Because part of your claim is that the money that you're getting is not what you're entitled to, right?
That is part of our claim. That's the ultimate goal of our claim, I should say. Our claim, the reason that this is a suit about the procedure and not the refund, is we contend that Notice 2650 was unlawfully promulgated, that it had to be subject to notice and comment rulemaking, that it's substantively unreasonable.
Substantively unreasonable because it doesn't give you as much money as you would like.
Not quite. Again, Judge Kavanaugh, I understand your recognition that at bottom we want the money back. And that's undeniably true in the end.
Right.
But when I talk about why we think it's substantively unreasonable, it's that there are literally tens of millions of people out there that had no idea the tax was being collected. The money could have been given back to them so easily back through the telephone company. The IRS told the telephone company they don't have to turn over the records. Those are points about process. And our fundamental point...
Points about process for people other than your clients.
Well, our clients, no class has been certified here, right, but that we do purport to represent a much broader class of people who really are not involved in the tax process. Now, whether we win or...
How many people did pursue the process? Is it something like 90 million actually pursue? How many people did pursue the process?
I think about 11 million.
11 million.
Yeah.
I understand your point about much of the relief you seek being process-oriented, but what about the aspect of your relief that seeks the challenges of 3-year statute of limitations? I mean, that will directly result, if you're right, in different assessments of tax liability.
Well,
individuals.
Well, I would say, to be perfectly honest, ultimately, every procedural objection that's brought in court has a substantive.
Well, but not. I mean, your notice and comment claim may or may not have an impact on ultimate tax assessment. Same thing with respect to whether or not these claims are filed through your tax return or through, through the phone company. But the challenge to the 3-year statute, that we know what that will do. That will dramatically change the assessment of the tax, correct?
That will not change
retroactively.
The assessment of the tax is a term of art.
Yeah, I understand, let me put it differently. Yeah. It will dramatically affect an individual's tax liability.
And we hope,
whereas the other ones are truly process oriented, this one really isn't. And the courts have said we have to look at what the purpose of the suit is, right? That's what Bob Jones says.
Well, right? Remember, the reason that you have to look at the Supreme Court focuses on the purpose of the lawsuit in Bob Jones is that the statute at issue in Bob Jones, which is the AIA, says, except as provided in specified section, no suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax, right? That there's a quite specific reason that the Supreme Court is very focused on the purpose of a suit about the collection of taxes, which is what's going on in Bob Jones. It doesn't want anybody trying to block the IRS from taking the money in the first instance. What there isn't, we think, is evidence that is clear and convincing of a congressional intent to withdraw, uniquely for the IRS, the ability to challenge regulations relating to the determination of refunds. I admit, Judge Tatel.
And you're saying that you don't have to go through the procedure first in order to get here That is, to get to a lawsuit. There was a regulatory procedure, which you didn't go through, right?
That is correct. So let me just say, our root position is, in order to challenge the lawfulness of a refund procedure, as opposed to seek a refund, mm-hmm. in order to challenge the lawfulness of a refund procedure, you don't have to seek the refund first. And that's just
yeah. Are we going to open the door to every time somebody says a regulatory procedure is improper, they get to come to court without trying it out first?
No. I think that's
a precedent that could have grave implications for this court.
Chief Judge Santel, I agree with you. And I think it is important that we satisfy the court that this is not a backdoor opportunity to come in and evade the laws that have been passed by Congress.
Go ahead and satisfy me of that.
Okay. The statute that Judge Tatel referred to, and in Bob Jones, the Supreme Court address, says that you can't do anything that's directed at the purpose of stopping the assessment and collection of taxes. And the statute, Section 7422 says you can't bring a lawsuit to get a refund. Our claim is entirely directed at a very special and unique process that was created by the IRS. And it's quite rare that the service does something like this, creates a very unusual system for getting a refund of a very particular tax. And all we are allowed to do is challenge this new procedure that's created for them.
My immediate concern is you're challenging a regulatory procedure without testing the procedure. Normally, we would look for an exhaustion. You're saying you don't have to have it because you're challenging the procedure.
Chief Judge,
many, many, many people come here telling us that something's wrong with their regulation by some agency or other. We don't have just the IRS. We have all the agencies. And normally we will have expected them to have exhausted the administrative procedure first before they come to court. Why are you different?
I actually think, with respect, I think that the language that I quoted from the Supreme Court in McCarthy and that this court has repeatedly
with respect, quoted again.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
In a similar vein, exhaustion has not been required where the challenge is to the adequacy of the agency procedure itself, such that, quote, and they're quoting themselves again, this is all a Supreme Court quote, the question of the adequacy of the administrative remedy is for all practical purposes identical with the merits of the plaintiff's lawsuit. Right.
But here you start out attacking the procedure by saying it was not adopted by proper notice and comment.
Yes.
That isn't even uncommon. And yet we do not usually expect plaintiffs to just show up here suing without testing it in some fashion administrative.
Really? Chief Judge,
that's not an uncommon challenge. That's not an uncommon challenge.
I think our
the adoption of the regulation was in some way irregular. It's not uncommon.
I agree with you, but I think that it's also not uncommon for this court to adjudicate that claim in the first instance. The agency issues something, and we say that has to be done in notice and comment rulemaking, and you go to court and you prove under the APA that it's invalid from the beginning. What the Supreme Court has not required is that you go through that process in order to make, and this is kind of like the ripeness argument, to be honest, and that is, has something happened to us? And so maybe we should recognize that the two issues are related. We are affected immediately. Our clients were required to go through a process. This is, I think, on all four with Abbott Labs. I actually don't think this is a situation like the dissent with respect referred to where some benefit is being accorded to us, where the courts require you to go through the process and be denied the benefit. Everybody agrees this is our money. And so what we have been required to do in order to get our money back is to go through a process. And that is a process that is subject to the APA.
Well, wait, on the everyone agrees it's your money. Actually, there's a dispute over the period for which, as Judge Tatel was pointing out, you can recover. So there's a dispute over whether it's your money for that. And then there's also a dispute, as I understand it, but correct me if I'm wrong, over whether you have to show have documentation to get more than the amount the IRS was giving.
Well, again, I actually don't
think that would be a dispute also over whether it's your
money. I agree there are disputes in the case, but nobody actually does dispute it's our money. The IRS only wants to give us 3 years of it back, right? But nobody, something can be outside the statute of limitations. That's my point simply,
okay.
Right? And this is actually really fits well with the reason we have exhaustion. The reason that the IRS constantly wants, if we were to actually step back for a second and think about a legal regime that makes any sense, the reason the IRS would want people to actually seek the refund first is so they could figure out how much money is owed, Whether there was, whether it was owed in the first place, I suppose. But all the things that the IRS would want to consider in receiving our refund application are already completely settled. Nobody doubts that the process that they want is totally meaningless. What they would ask for is for tens of millions of people to send in, I guess, some sort of form, which they will not resolve anything related to this case, right? They are not going to consider our arguments. The reason we think the statutes distinguish the process from the substance of the refund is if you think about what the IRS would consider if they got these tens of millions of forms in, none of them would, they wouldn't consider for a second whether Notice 2006-50 is an adequate remedy, what the right period is, what the right forms are.
But then you could get judicial review of that.
I agree. My point is that we are not required by law to do it.
Right.
And the question is, would Congress have intended that result? Would Congress have intended, if we're just stepping back and trying to figure out what a sensible result here is,
We're not.
Okay.
Really, you're not going to suggest we try to get sensible results. I'm not really kidding.
Well, I am trying.
We cannot analyze tax law on that basis.
My hope is that we haven't lost sight entirely of if Congress says to do something, we're going to do it.
I don't want you to run out of time without asking you to go back to your point earlier with respect to the Declaratory Judgment Act and its relationship to the Anti-Injunction Act, that, quote, you don't care about that.
Yes.
Would you say a little more about that?
Okay, there's a big academic debate and a debate.
No, I know about the debate, but I gather this is your way of saying we don't have to resolve that, right?
Exactly right. So,
and is that because you're no longer seeking declaratory relief?
No, we are seeking declaratory relief, but it wouldn't make a difference to the outcome of this case. Because
I understood your brief as saying you could get anything you wanted through the injunction.
Yes.
Well, then why are you still seeking declaratory relief?
Because I'm just not abandoning it.
If you're seeking it, don't we then have to resolve that question?
I think that the court could conclude that the declaratory relief that we seek is completely academic in light of the fact that we're seeking injunctive relief. If the court
Has any court ever said that?
Well, interestingly, Judge Kavanaugh, this issue arises only in cases where people are trying to evade the Anti-Injunction Act and aren't seeking an injunction and are just seeking a declaration, right? That was the point of the statute. Right. People try and sneak around the AIA. This isn't that case. So nobody has ever held that we don't have to consider whether the DJA means something, because every time the DJA comes up, the plaintiff is just seeking a declaratory judgment. We are not. We have to confront the AIA. If we can't survive the Anti-Injunction Act, then we can't get our injunction. Our point is that the Anti-Injunction Act is limited to suits about the collection of taxes. This is not a suit about the collection of taxes.
But if you're still seeking... I'm sorry.
If you don't succeed in getting that injunction, then does the DJA matter?
It does. But the reasons that we would not get an injunction, I think, would kill us under the Declaratory Judgment Act. We're not going to be perfectly honest... The Anti-Injunction Act is so far afield from our claim, right? We're not seeking to ban the assessment or collection of taxes. If we are going to lose under our injunctive claim, it's going to be a broader principle about having to always seek a refund. It's going to be under
7%. Do you disagree that there is such a principle?
Oh, we agree that the principle is limited to what's articulated in the text. And the best text for them is
in the Judiciary Act when it says that equity is not available when there's an adequate remedy at law.
I think that is articulated much more specifically in the APA, which says if you have an adequate remedy of law. So I'm not trying to evade it.
We have cases, lots of cases, and so does the Supreme Court, that repeatedly say injunctive relief is not available where there's an adequate remedy at law. Is that principle, apply? Does that not apply?
It applies in the sense that it's also said, I think, just as specifically in the APA.
Okay.
So I'm not trying to evade
The APA?
The APA.
Okay.
Yes, because that statute says if you've got an adequate, so we've got to prove that we don't have an adequate remedy of law. On that point, our position is that adequate means legal. And so it just collapses into the merits of our claim. Notice 2006-50 is illegal, we say. If we're right, it is not an adequate remedy. If I could reserve the balance of my time.
But on the bare question of the coterminous or non-coterminous nature of the statutes, if we hold that the Declaratory Judgment Act is broader in its application.
Yes.
And you can't get declaratory judgment.
Yes.
You can still go for your injunction.
Anyway. Exactly right.
Well, can I ask about that? Can I ask about that? It's not clear to me that that's right at all.
Yeah,
that is,
right.
I take it the IRS's the position is that if the Declaratory Judgment Act is the scope and it's broader and it is not limited either before or after collection or assessment,
yes,
you can't get a declaratory judgment or an injunction in the refund suit either.
Well, that, I agree that's their position. They're just wrong.
No. But if the hypothetical Judge Sentell put to you was, if you can't get anything because of the Declaratory Judgment Act, can you still get what you want in a refund suit?
I've asked in an injunction act.
Yeah, so here's the deal. If we're going to be serious about the text of the Declaratory Judgment Act so that it says related to taxes, we have to be serious about the whole text, and it only applies to declaratory judgments. It doesn't bleed over into our ability to get injunctive relief, which is covered by the Anti-Injunction Act, and which is only limited to the assessment or collection of taxes. So if we lose the Declaratory Judgment Act, I'll be sad.
No, what I'm saying is if they are coterminously broad.
I see.
Then the Injunction Act has to be read.
Right.
Not according to its
plain text,
but according to affecting text.
Okay. So
I'm suggesting that if they're not coterminous.
Exactly. The premise of the Chief Judge's question is that they're not coterminous. Now, if you say, all right, this all, like a sort of jujitsu, turns around on us, and that we say they're coterminous, and you conclude that the DJA is broader, I just don't think that tracks. The reason we take the DJA seriously.
That wasn't a question I asked. Ah. I appreciate that you don't think it tracks. I'm asking you the hypothetical.
Yeah.
If it did track, would you be able to get anything out of a refund?
So, no.
Right. That's what I thought.
It's also an issue. I understood your question as saying if you're right that you can get anything, everything you need under the Anti-Injunction Act, we wouldn't have to resolve the question of the scope of the declaratory judgment, but we do, right?
Well, you
we have to deal with the government's argument that the Declaratory Judgment Act, broad as it is, limits even the Anti-Injunction Act remedy, right? We have to do that.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. Our tax system has been chastised for being very complex. And in many respects it is, but what is simple is how judicial challenges are made to our tax system. Despite all the dire metaphors and the hyperbolic descriptions in the appellant's brief, the bottom line is that Congress has parried all their thrusts by requiring that district court challenges to taxes be in the form of a refund suit. There is simply no warrant in the law for a standalone APA challenge to any tax program. IRS has...
What do you do with the case law that Mr. Goldstein was reading from, the MacArthur case, saying that, in fact, we do not require litigants who are challenging the procedure to go through the procedures first? Therefore, there is no adequate remedy.
Well, there is an adequate remedy. The remedy they seek is they want their... Bottom line, they want their money back, okay? They have every person they purport to represent can still file a 1040X for the year 2006 and get their telephone tax refund.
Isn't there a point that people who don't file income tax returns and who have paid very little of this excise tax aren't going to do that?
Well, they're...
In fact, the government has only refunded half of the amount of money that was collected, which is a pretty good indication of the fact that people aren't filing these things. Nobody has an incentive to do it unless you're a big corporation.
That's their argument,
isn't it? Their point is that it's inadequate because millions of taxpayers, non-taxpayers, aren't going to use it.
I'm sure there are millions of taxpayers out there today that probably have refund claims that don't file them. The point is IRS, Congress has said, IRS, you are not giving back money unless a citizen files a refund claim. This program was set up to make it easier for the...
This program was to make it easier?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
This program was to make it easier?
Actually, it was, because IRS had received tens of thousands of refund claims once the government lost these telephone cases. So it said, do we want to have 80 million separate pieces of paper? They said, well, that's what Congress provided. Can we make it easier? And they said, yeah, let's put a box on the 2006 tax return. That was actually not an easy process. They had to do it fast before the 2006 filing season. And today, even if you never filed a 2006 return, you never checked the box, you can file a 1040X, as I mentioned, for 2006, and IRS will send you your $30 or $40 or whatever it is. And you can submit your the other form that said if you paid more money, IRS will return it. They have,
on the complexity of it, I thought about 90 million people did take advantage of this. And then there's maybe 10 million, 20 million who did not. Is that roughly accurate? What are the numbers?
Well, apparently that's what one of the internal studies showed. But even those 10 million people who haven't still have time to do that. So when my opponent says there's no adequate remedy at law, that's completely false.
When you say people have checked the box, that's for a flat amount that may not be the amount that they actually paid, right?
No, but if you do not want that set amount, then you file the other, you attach that other form to it and say,
And how many people did that?
I don't know.
You don't
know.
You don't know the
people did that. Some people clearly did.
Yes, I appreciate some people did. But your large millions numbers that you're throwing around, those are the people who checked the box.
Yes, the 80 or 90 million check one of the boxes.
So your opponent's position is that you've made it's so difficult to get the amount of money that you're actually entitled to because people don't keep their own records of payment of taxes, that people have been forced, if they want anything at all, to just check the box. This is a merits dispute about whether this is easy or not. But I don't think you can say that the fact that large numbers of people simply check the box means that you have a program that's legal. Well, that's the merits question.
If I could step back, there is no requirement that the IRS process a refund claim under the law. If IRS were today to say, you know, we're too busy and we're not going to process any refund claim under $1,000, you could not challenge
this
that.
This is still an argument. It's a tough argument and it's a merits argument. It's not the argument saw it on bank on.
Well, the plaintiffs here are complaining about process. Well, the Supreme Court said in a case we cite on page 36 of our brief, Heckler versus Ringler, that you can't separate. The Supreme Court rejected the Court of Appeals, which had separated particular claims into substantive and procedural elements. I mean, if this basically, the plaintiffs here are saying, IRS set up a program, we don't like it, we think it's unfair, and we're going to go into court. There is no jurisdiction for a court to decide that an IRS program is unfair. The jurisdiction is, did you overpay your taxes? If so, are you entitled to your money back?
What do you do about the fact that the text of the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't apply to this kind of suit?
It depends how broadly you want to interpret the Anti-Injunction Act. I mean, there are lots of cases that say any step along the road to assessment and collection is barred by the Anti-Injunction Act. So you have cases which IRS seeks records. They go, no, you can't enjoin that because eventually it may need to lead to assessment and collection.
But at this point, aren't all these steps we're talking about after assessment and collection are finished?
Yeah.
If this case is a case where assessment and collection is finished, right?
Well, but the question is, what did Congress intend by the Anti-Injunction Act?
Now, well, the question is, what do the mean words assessment or collection mean?
Yeah.
And you agree, don't you, that the assessment and collection of these taxes has been concluded?
IRS has collected. They're currently in the Treasury. But if they're...
The meaning of the words assessment or collection in the Internal Revenue Code, you agree or do you not agree that is concluded with respect to the taxes at issue here?
The taxes have been collected. That is true.
But and assessed and collected.
They've been assessed and collected.
Right.
But our point
is... Therefore, how can you interpret the words of the Anti-Injunction Act to have anything to do with this lawsuit?
Well,
it doesn't matter how broadly you interpret or how narrowly, it just doesn't cover this lawsuit.
If the plaintiff's argument is to be accepted, then they would agree that... Well, let's have a revenue agent.
You don't want to answer our questions about the.
Well, I'm trying to answer your
three
question.
Three of us have tried now.
I take it your answer to the question is that we have to read the Anti-Injunction Act to mean the same thing as the Declaratory Judgment Act, right?
Well, our bottom line is
the argument you make in your brief. Is it assessment and collection is what it really means is what's in the Declaratory Judgment Act, right?
That is
correct. So how the Declaratory Judgment Act was passed in 1934, right?
35. 1 year after the...
All right, well, what 34, 35 is irrelevant to my question, which is courts were issuing injunctions long before that. I mean, courts, when a court issues an injunction, it doesn't have to issue a declaratory judgment.
No.
So why would the Declaratory Judgment Act limit a court's authority to issue an injunction?
Well, the Declaratory Judgment Act also says, I believe it's section 2202, says if once you have a declaratory judgment, you can then issue other orders in aid of the declaratory
judgment. Sure, that's one way to do it. But you could file an injunction action without seeking a declaratory judgment. In fact, taxpayers here say they don't even need their declaratory relief. They can get everything they want through their injunction. And I just don't see what's the argument for reading the language of the Anti-Injunction Act, or ignoring the language of the Anti-Injunction Act and inserting into it instead the language from the Declaratory Judgment Act. I'm having trouble with that step.
Yeah. Well, because the genesis of the Anti-Injunction Act way back in the 1800s was that without the Anti-Injunction Act, this Supreme Court said in the old case called Cheatham that, quote, the very existence of government might be placed in the power of a hostile judiciary. Now, our point is this. If you say that you can have a standalone APA case to withdraw money from the Treasury, that's basically saying, okay, there is no injunction before the revenue agent walks through the doors of the IRS building. But once the revenue agent walks through the doors of the IRS building with that $50, then a court can say, oh, I can issue an injunction.
Well, if you think it's important in that respect, then I guess you ought to go to Congress and get them to pass a law that prevents the issuance of injunction. But that's not what they did. Let me ask you to look at Section 7422, which is the other one you're looking at. That, again, uses the same words, assessed or collected, right?
Yes,
and it says no suit shall be maintained in any court for the recovery of the tax alleged to have been erroneously or illegally assessed or collected, which again suggests that Congress is using those words as terms of art, that those occur before the money hits the Treasury, and that it doesn't occur afterwards, so that the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't apply once it has been assessed or collected.
I will freely admit that the Anti-Injunction Act can be interpreted, you could legitimately interpret it narrowly or broadly.
Well, I don't understand how you can legitimately interpret the words. That is, if we're going to be textual about this, I don't understand how the words assessed or collected can apply after the tax has already been assessed or collected.
Only if you accept the principle that money is fungible, and the whole idea is that
has nothing to do with what you're being asked. The words just don't mean that, do they? Your better argument is really under 7422, isn't it, rather than under the Anti-Injunction
Act? Well, our better argument is that if they have an adequate remedy at law, and they do, that there's no warrant
argument.
For
that's
this,
another
for
good
this
argument.
Yeah, that should. Why are you making that argument?
Pick which ditch you want to die in.
Why aren't you making
that
argument?
I'm making that argument.
Okay, my understanding, because at the panel level, as I said to Mr. Goldstein, we were bound by precedent, but for the in-bank, we don't have to follow the panel precedent. I've tried to go back and figure out what the Anti-Injunction Act was actually doing. My understanding was, but it's murky, is that there actually was a longstanding principle before the Anti-Injunction Act that you can't get injunctive relief where there's an adequate remedy available at law. And they passed the Anti-Injunction Act, although, again, this is murky, in 1867, to make sure courts didn't create exceptions to that, because in equity, courts create all sorts of exceptions, and they didn't want any in the restraining assessment. But that statute is merely one codification of a much longer principle. That's what Bob Jones says. And you should be relying on the broader principles. If the text of the statute, as the questions reveal, to my mind, the text of the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't get you anywhere.
Well, it is not helpful unless you interpret the words very broadly.
I mean, unless you ignore the words.
That over and over, and you have, whoa, just a minute. You've said that over and over, but you've never shown any possible interpretation of those words, no matter how broad, that encompasses what we're talking about here. The words just don't mean that. And saying, well, interpret them broadly, you can't use the word white and interpret it broadly and say it means black. And that's what you're wanting us to do, is interpret these words to mean something totally different than they said. That's not breadth. That's misinterpretation.
What we want this court to do is say there is no warrant for a standalone APA claim of the type they have brought.
So quit beating that horse about the broad interpretation of the Anti-Injunction Act.
Right. And because there's an adequate remedy available at all, namely that they can bring all the claims in the refund suit. That's your argument, right?
That's precisely our argument.
And whether that's true or not is what we're debating, whether it's really an adequate remedy when, as Mr. Goldstein says, you're at least in part attacking the procedure.
Is the question of the adequate remedy what was really motivating the Anti-Injunction Act, or was it the principle that Congress doesn't
I couldn't hear your question.
Right. I'm asking about what was motivating, what motivated Congress when it passed the Anti-Injunction Act. Wasn't it, we've been talking about whether there's an adequate, whether it was just an embodiment of the equitable principle that, you know, you can't seek an injunction unless there's a, unless there's no adequate remedy. Well, I thought the purpose of the statute was to keep the courts out of tax assessment and collections, that Congress wanted the money assessed, collected, and into the Treasury before there was any litigation over at all.
Agreed.
Isn't that what's behind it?
Yes.
Okay, so that doesn't apply in this case at all, does it? The money is assessed, collected in the Treasury, and the government has conceded that it was improperly collected.
Yes.
So that principle, so not only do we have a situation where the language of the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't apply, assessment and collection, but its purpose doesn't apply either.
Well, the problem with looking at the Anti-Injunction Act without looking also at the Declaratory Judgment Act and how it applies to...
Well, wait, why don't you just, let's set aside the Declaratory Judgment Act for just a minute. Do you agree with what I just said, if all we're looking at is the Anti-Injunction Act, that that would be the right result?
That if you only had the Anti-Injunction Act, the money's already been collected?
Right.
Well, under the words of the statute, right. Then you'd need something, okay. You would need something else.
And you would also agree that the Anti-Injunction Act was designed by Congress to keep the courts out of the process of assessment and collection, right? So the courts wouldn't interfere with the machinery of tax collection.
Right.
Okay. So setting aside if we're not looking then at the if we just look at the Anti-Injunction Act alone, you would agree that it doesn't bar this case either by its language or by its purpose. So the government's whole argument then turns on the Declaratory Judgment Act, right?
Well, it turns on the Declaratory Judgment Act, but it also turns on you're not entitled to an injunction if you have an adequate remedy at law. So you don't even have to get to the words of the injunction. You don't even have to get to the words of the Anti-Injunction Act.
Is that argued in your brief?
In our brief, yes. We mentioned that if the statute of limitations has not run,
Does the government
recover? The Internal Revenue Manual, IRS has published guidance in the Internal Revenue Manual. I'll give you the site because the Internal Revenue Manual has this very screwy system. But anyway, Internal Revenue Manual 21.6.3.5, I apologize, that's what it is, October 2nd, 2009, provides as follows, quote, "The refund statute is open for 6 years from July 26, 2006 to July 26, 2012. Every taxpayer that Mr. Goldstein purports to represent can get their telephone tax refund.
You could, if I understand what happens in your view in the refund suit, you could ignore the court's decision each time and require each new taxpayer to dispute the notice again, correct? The IRS's position is non-acquiescence, isn't it?
Well, the IRS's position is if we have a legal position that we think is right, just because we lose in one court doesn't mean that we give up.
So you could litigate that, and your position is you can't. Your position is the court cannot issue an injunction or a declaratory judgment in the refund suit, correct?
Correct.
Okay. The Bob Jones Court said exactly the opposite in footnote 22. Said in a refund suit. At the panel level, the IRS conceded exactly this point, that in the refund suit, injunctive and declaratory relief can occur.
You have, if you have a legitimate refund suit, the court has jurisdiction.
So when you conceded it at the panel level, is that concession no longer applicable in response to Judge Garland's question?
Well, no, maybe I didn't understand the question. If you have a proper refund suit, you can raise whatever argument.
But you can't get a declaratory right. judgment or an injunction. And in footnote 22 of Bob Jones, the court repeats the fact that that is the IRS's position, and the court doesn't have to resolve that question. So that is your position, that you can require each, whatever 100 millions of Americans who apply and who are forced into refund suits in order to get this, each one to litigate the case individually, right? Because you think, obviously, that this notice is fine. So if you lose once, you're still going to think it's fine.
Well, Congress set up our tax system.
I didn't ask. I'm not asking you to give me a discussion about the pleasures of the tax system.
What are you seeking?
I'm asking you, is your position that in a refund suit, all that anybody can get is money? They cannot get a declaratory judgment. They cannot get an injunction. Court can't declare that the notice is unlawful. Court can't enjoin you against using this notice.
No, in a refund suit, courts have declared statutes unconstitutional in a refund suit.
Well, how can that be if the Declaratory Judgment Act says, in your view, that no declaratory judgments are possible with respect to taxes? And if your view about with respect to taxes is broader than just assessment or collection, but has anything to do with taxes?
I'm referring to a standalone Declaratory Judgment Act. A refund suit, you already have jurisdiction.
But do you have jurisdiction only to get a refund, or do you have jurisdiction to make a declaratory judgment in that?
Well, you can make any declaration in a refund suit that says taxpayer either gets his money back or doesn't get his money back.
And that's because the Supreme Court said there's an exception to the DJA in South Carolina versus Regan, right?
Well, that exception was if there is no other relief
exactly,
available.
Exactly. So in the refund suit, you can get the declaration and injunctive relief.
Because
can you get the declaration and injunctive relief that the procedures are inadequate, that the notice procedures are inadequate in the refund suit?
If that affects your right to receiving money back, you could. I mean, the point is where do courts have jurisdiction under our tax system? And the courts don't have jurisdiction of a standalone APA. What the courts, and again, I come back to this hypothetical, if IRS tomorrow were to say, we are no longer going to process refund claims, period. Just said, we don't have enough people to do it. You could not file a judicial challenge to that program.
What you could file would be each taxpayer could file for a refund.
Every taxpayer in this country can file for a refund if they think they have overpaid their taxes. That's the way the system works.
That's leading with your chin a little.
Sorry, I couldn't.
That is leading with your chin a little. Say that we can just ignore everything. That's not a great argument.
No, it would be terrible politics, and Congress would not like it.
That's the greatest argument to make to a court, Joe.
I'm talking about when the court would have jurisdiction, and I'm trying to give you a hypothetical way out the extremes, just like they would do in the Supreme Court, and say, okay, how far would this go? This, if you were to hold that this lawsuit is permissible, anyone could file a lawsuit anytime they didn't like an IRS program.
Well, this case, saying that this case is different because the collection and the assessment are concluded and it's not going to happen again. So that's not the same as a situation where there's ongoing tax situation.
Well, there are lots of other taxes that come and go, and if somebody doesn't like the next program, IRS says, we're going to have a different way of processing refunds.
I guess the next time that you ignore five regional courts of appeals, and finally after the sixth agree to pay back, but only if you file an extremely difficult notice, yes, that's correct. That would be the same as this case. But I'm not hearing what other cases it would be.
IRS issues, this was notice 2006-50. There are 2006-1 through 49. Anybody else who didn't like that could then file, okay, I'm going to file a lawsuit.
That's not right, actually, because this is only about refunds. So it's only going to be refund regulations. You know, I don't think, I think the reason this case is important is probably not the amount of refund challenges that could be brought in court, although that's an interesting issue. It's because this is a $10 billion with a B dollar case, right? I mean, that's what matters here.
Well, actually, what matters
is it's not going to be every IRS regulation related to collection and assessment. So withholding regulations, amount of tax owed, all of those are still going to be subject to the same Anti-Injunction Act bar, even if you lose this case, as I understand it. The only thing, the only door that would be opened, and it, maybe it's significant, but I don't think so in the grand scheme of things, is the are the is the door for IRS regulations related to refunds.
Well, but there are other programs. If we want to take the case currently in the Supreme Court involving medical residents and FICA taxes, that was a similar program where IRS was fighting whether pre-2005 medical residents were subject to FICA. Lots of claims came in. IRS eventually lost a bunch of cases, eventually said prior to 2005, we're going to give up. Okay? Suppose somebody else wanted to come in and say, you know, I don't like that process.
That example cited in the brief?
I don't believe that example is cited.
That's the kind of thing that would be useful.
You have said a couple of times that there is, quote, no warrant for a standalone APA claim. And I just want to understand what is the basis of that. There, the APA exists. You are not, as near as I can tell, specifically exempted from that. So when you say the APA, you know, no warrant for it, in other words, you don't have jurisdiction to look at APA claims, what's the basis of that? Is it your argument that there is this adequate remedy at law, or is it the argument that because of the way you interpret these statutes, they preclude the APA?
Well, you need, it's actually two or three answers. Number one, adequate remedy at law. Number two, you need APA suit with final agency action that affects citizens in a concrete way. This has not affected citizens in a concrete way because they...
Well, that argument I don't think is before the court. That's already been decided. That's gone. So what's your next position?
The argument is that Congress has said this is has set up in 7422. If you want your money back and IRS has collected it, this is the way you do it, and that is via a refund suit. This is not a refund suit. If you want to challenge IRS actions and you...
Well, now, that's very interesting because you said it's not a refund suit. So it is an APA suit. Are you conceding that?
No. I'm saying this suit is not a proper refund suit. I don't want to misspeak. This is not a proper refund. This is not a refund suit. They're seeking a refund. It's not a proper suit, and there's no jurisdiction for it. What I've been trying to emphasize is that if IRS has your money, Congress has said this is how you get it back. Okay? These taxpayers are not aggrieved. They've not suffered a concrete injury. They can still, every one of these plaintiffs can file, if they have not received a refund, can file.
I'm going to stop you there because they're saying they're not getting enough money back, that their money is being withheld by the IRS and that they are not getting what they're entitled to. So how can you say they're not aggrieved?
They're not aggrieved unless they ask for their money back the way Congress has said you ask for your money back. That's exactly why.
I thought you were saying they were not aggrieved at all.
Whenever IRS collects too much money, everyone theoretically is aggrieved, but unless
you're aggrieved. They are aggrieved.
Yeah, unless
everyone is aggrieved and you collect too much money. The aggrievement doesn't get you anywhere.
But aggrieved in the legal sense is that you don't have an adequate remedy at law. They clearly have an adequate remedy.
No, if you didn't have, if you wouldn't need a remedy if you weren't aggrieved. You are aggrieved.
Anytime you overpay your taxes, you're aggrieved.
Right.
Having admitted that,
why don't you get off those? They are aggrieved. You can't win on that one.
Well, I believe we can win on the fact that there has been no concrete injury here. There's no final agency action.
There may not be final agency action. That's not the same as the question of aggrievement.
But there's concrete injury. The question here is the timing of the suit, not the availability of the suit. But there's an injury.
Oh, there is clear. Every citizen who paid telephone tax, who wants it back, if they go through the proper steps, could have a legitimate lawsuit.
Right.
This is not it.
Right.
And for the court to accept jurisdiction in a case like this would be absolutely unprecedented. Does the court have any further questions? Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel. Have time left. You have 3 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Judge. If you ever wanted to know why Congress passed the APA, just replay the last 30 minutes. The point of the statute is that we don't have agencies who say, hey, you know, if we just don't feel like giving people their money back, that's tough. The reason that we have a...
That's not going to be a sustainable position, but the question here is really the timing.
Well, Judge Kavanaugh, I'll come to the timing, and I agree with you. All right, I'm totally with you. I'm just saying thematically, we know Congress passed the APA for a reason. As Judge Brown says, there's no exception for the IRS. I think we just figured out why. Now, on 7422, the core of the question is going to be, if this is a suit for a refund, we filed without the proper procedure. So that's the question. If this is a refund suit, then it's subject to 7422A. There is a timing requirement. If it is not a suit for a refund, then we would only lose if there is an adequate remedy at law because we wouldn't satisfy the APA. We contend there is not an adequate remedy of law. That's the merits of our claim. If it's illegal, I don't think you can call it adequate. So I think the heart of the question, if we're going to lose this case, it's because under...
But in the refund suit, couldn't the court in the refund suit say, this notice is illegal and shall not be... enforced further?
No, I don't think so. Remember, footnote 22 does not resolve that question.
It's not finally resolved, but it's a good lean.
Well, I don't think so. Look, the
and cannot be enforced further. The IRS position is clear that could not issue. That would be an injunction.
I agree. And then 7422, just
that's the IRS's position. It's not the Supreme Court's.
Okay. Supreme Court hasn't resolved it. I don't want to run out of time, but I will tell you the Declaratory Judgment Act, which is where this declaration would come from, right, is not a timing statute. It says you cannot have...
The Supreme Court in Regan read an exception to that.
If you don't have an adequate remedy at law, but the IRS will say you do, that's their position here. Just file another refund claim. Get the next person in here. Bring us 50 million worthless refund claims and then get 50 million...
Couldn't the individual case could be appealed up to the Supreme Court, right?
But you couldn't get a declaratory judgment. This is not hypothetical. The IRS had a ruling from the 11th Circuit that this statute was unlawful, and it wrote a regulation that says we don't care. We will continue to collect this tax in the 11th Circuit. This is not an agency that, remember, the first Supreme Court case he cites is the judiciary running amok. Our system of laws generally doesn't regard that as kind of an evil thing. All we want is to not have...
Well, we do regard the judiciary running amok as an evil thing.
Well,
I think that's an
we don't really regard it as running amok.
I think his quote was that
we
the judiciary is hostile.
Yeah, it's not. Right. Okay, can I just say the bottom line here? The sensible thing that Congress intended in the APA is to go through this one time, not 50 million times. Let's figure out if this notice is legal or not have 50 million refund actions, and we won't have non-acquiescence. We will get a judgment under the APA whether this refund process is lawful or not. There's a perfectly sensible reading of the statutes. I'll stop.
Do you agree that it's limited to refund regulations?
Yes.
Okay, so if the IRS has an illegal withholding regulation that's promulgated in a legal way, the Anti-Injunction Act bars challenge.
Yes, and that's the answer to his FICA example. Thank you.
Time is up, unless my colleagues have further questions. Seeing none, the case is submitted. Give us recess.
Stand, please. Our report now stands adjourned until Thursday, October 7th at
30 a.m. Sir,
pleasure time.
As always,
pleasure time.
Thanks.